Blog Talk Radio.
I loathe such things as jazz.
I don't belong to any club or group. I don't get drunk, go to church. I don't go to analysts. I don't endorse books, sign books.
Fake thinkers, puffed up poets, Freud, Marx.
Nabokov was an enigmatic figure, difficult to label or pin down. He was born into the Russian aristocracy in 1899, fled his homeland during the Bolshevik Revolution, and was then chased from Europe by the Nazis to America. Just as important to Nabokov as his writing was butterfly hunting.
Is there any connection with your writing?
There is in a general way, because I think that in a work of art, there is a kind of merging between the two things, between the precision of poetry and the excitement of pure science.
What he presented to the world, when he chose to appear before it at all, that is, was a mask that deliberately concealed his true feelings.
Nabokov only came to Montreux in the first place because, for some reason, it reminded him of Russia, of where he grew up.
Did you ever try to go back to Russia just to have a look at it?
There's nothing to look at. I would not wish to spoil the images in my mind.
Ever since being banished from the paradise of his childhood, Nabokov's obsession was with fleeting beauty and how to recapture it. These are just 8 of the 43 cases in Nabokov's collection of more than 4,000 butterflies.
I tried to express as nearest to my vision of the world as I could. If the word cruel, I suppose it just means that I saw the world as cruel in those days. But I don't think that there's a special perverse or cruel streak in my writing. I mean, I'm in life, I'm a mild old gentleman. I'm very kind.
I really believe that one day a reappraiser will come and declare that far from being a frivolous firebird, I was a rigid moralist, kicking sin, cuffing stupidity, ridiculing the vulgar and the cruel, and assigning sovereign power to tenderness, talent, pride.
That was an interview with Vladimir Nabokov, and welcome to In Our Craft or Sullen Art. I am your host, Richard Weissman, and we are on the air on Late Night Poets, the largest poetry group on allpoetry.com, which they tell me is the largest poetry site. And my co-host, Neutron, is not able to join us tonight, but we have our own Pam Ray, who I am going to bring on the air right now. Hey, Pam.
Hey, Richard. How's it going?
Good, good. So glad you could join me again.
Me too, me too. Neutron will be missed, of course, and I hope she hurries back to us.
Me too, yeah. I told her we're going to keep her seat warm. It's there waiting for her whenever she can get back, so hopefully soon. I do have someone else on the line. I think it's probably Laurent. Let me just bring him on. We can start talking.
Wonderful.
Good evening, Richard.
Hey,
good evening, Pam.
Hi, Lauren.
Hey,
good
so
to hear
glad
you.
You could join us tonight.
Oh, a pleasure.
Yeah, did you hear that intro, the interview with Nabokov?
I did, and it's always fascinating to hear someone that has always been, familiar to you through his writing, but somehow larger than life and unapproachable, than to hear him as a human. Not as a god, for instance, talking is always interesting, fascinating, love his points of view. It was a great interview.
I thought so as well. Yeah. Well, let's get Pam's view. What did you think of the interview?
I enjoyed it. I actually managed this time to listen to it ahead of time, so I could absorb it a little better. At least I hope. And I actually have never read Nabokov, although obviously I've heard of them because who hasn't heard of Lolita? It is rather an infamous novel, you know. So, but yeah, I really like how it delved into a bit of his, the way he almost had a nostalgia for his childhood and yet at the same time avoided, you know, necessarily going back to it. I really like how it talked about his butterfly collecting, that idea of seeking beauty, and it's reflecting the temporary nature of it. But to me, the most profound part, the most hard-hitting part, was the very end where he said, you know, that he will hopes that eventually someone will see him as a moralist. And I think for someone who wrote such a controversial novel as Lolita, that's very important because, and I know this was in a quote somewhere, not necessarily by Nabokov, I can't remember who, but the idea that a lot of times banned books or attempted to be banned books are done so because people don't like the fact that somebody holds a mirror up to their own sins. And so I thought that was just extremely well stated in that interview. So excellent great choice of an intro there, Richard, and very cool.
Thanks. Yeah, so I don't want to steal the whole two-hour show, but I do think that I agree with Nabokov. I mean, first of all, just a brilliant writer, and I do think he's a moralist. I think that the way that you get us to hearken to the angels of our better nature is by exposing Jungian's shadow to the clear antiseptic of, you know, of the spotlight, and that's what he does in Lolita. So even beyond like the obvious metaphors of, you know, that he's this, the protagonist is this European coming from, you know, the classical European literary circles and that high art European culture, which if you remember historically, after World War II, and a lot of them during World War II to escape the Nazis, did emigrate. I mean, that was the story of the New School for Social Research, was a bunch of, you know, university professors that had to leave Nazi Germany. So there was this emigration of Europe's intelligentsia into America, and which is represented by Lolita, of course, this young, you know, prepubescent, blah blah blah. So even if we ignore that level, I think my first statement is really the way to look at it, that you are a true moralist by showing immorality in the bright light, as opposed to letting it, you know, fester in hidden spaces that nobody likes to look at. And of course it's shocking. It's meant to be shocking.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so that's my read on it. I don't know. I what do you think, Laurent? Was he a moralist?
To a degree, I think so. If you look at morality, though, it's a target that sometimes shifts and can be taken from time period to time period as an inconstant constant, so to speak. But I agree with you. He made light of certain things. I mean, a lot of people wondered whether he was just being ridiculous or sublime. I might say a combination of both. I mean, when you look at Lolita and Pale Fire, for instance, marvelous works, mm-hmm. yet at the same time, he hated his early poetry. And his early poetry wasn't that good. But, I think in reflection, you could call him a moralist.
Yeah, I think, it's not an insane argument to make, certainly.
No.
Yep. Okay, so with that under our belt, now that we've kind of set the stage, let's see what all poetry's poets did inspired by some Nabokov quotes. So with that, Pam, I am turning it over to you for our first poem.
All right. Well, up first, we have "Nothing Interrupted the Stream, Not for Long Anyway" by Liquid Mind Forever. And Laurent, would you give that a read for us, please?
I'd be honored to. Excuse me. I've forgotten how. Forgotten how not to be afraid of my own shadow on the wall. The shadow crossing the street. Midnight shadows on the edge of your fishing blade, of the coming morning, of waiting, of going in or out, of answering the telephone, of mail, just afraid. How not to wait for la petite mort after each incoming breath, the death of anticipation, deflation of expectancy, ramifications of persistent inconsistencies. From birth I've been intimated, domesticated, truncated, violated, and penetrated with freedoms confiscated. Thought, trust, independence, hope, seldom but on occasion inside, alone, on cold nights with books. Books of Rod McEwen poems do these abstractions come to life, scraped off toilet walls or cardboard cereal boxes. Serial killer, knives rife with tripe. But what the heck? What's not contrived to feel alive, left to gripe about hype? His belt digs into my flesh, welts my future indentures and scars. Tongue and teeth bite hard into bottom lip. Circuits tripped, flipped channels, dismantled tin-type soldiers rusted, disgusted, crawl on all fours. And my yowl, silent as graveyard snow, cowers in the king's tower, awaiting asparagus hangman to lop off defiled remnants of undeveloped youth. Did I ever howl? When, if ever, did I know the yowl of fearlessness, tireless animal prowess beyond this mindless inferno's diurnal dialysis paralysis? Whenever I think back, the chink at the brink dissects every link. On Dick Clark's American Bandstand, I felt ripples of glee inside of me. The night I auditioned at New York's Gaslight Club. The day the real estate broker called to tell me my offer for my dream of a lifetime seaside cottage had been accepted. After that night, when fires swallowed any signposts of yowls, I died. Will I howl when death steals my physical last breath? And if I do, will it be for fear or for joy? Or will I destroy any standing mention I once might have received? Or will I refrain for fear of being deceived? End poem.
Wow. Nobody reads poetry like you, my friend. What an amazing read. You really brought that to life.
It's amazing.
And, it really is. Pam was asking how we wanted to start the show after the intro, obviously. And I wanted to start with this poem by Deborah because I kind of feel like it's throwing down the gauntlet for the evening. There's just so much here. The wordplay, the rhymes, the kind of it has this confessional tone to it. It's like it's almost like a muralist of poetry, a mural of poetry. Confessional, powerful. She lays her soul bare on the blank white cyber page, and we are truly enriched. Thought it was a great way to open up the evening of poetry, and I'm very appreciative that she brought it to us. And Pam, what did you think?
Yeah, I have to say throwing down the gauntlet is a great way to describe opening the show with this poem. It's a particularly powerful piece and a great take on the chosen prompt. Amazing imagery and metaphors. The main idea that I get from it is the idea of going through abuse and healing, not just healing to survive, but healing to find that strength of self. I really like it. You said the confessional style, especially when she brings in the personal details, like the night I auditioned at New York's Gaslight Club, the day the real estate broker called to tell me my offer. Having that like straightforward language in the middle of all the just play on words really added to the personal touch of the write. Another particular favorite of mine was from birth I've been intimidated, domesticated, tourniqueted, violated, and penetrated with freedom, confiscated, thought, trust, independence, hope, seldom, but on occasion inside, alone, on cold. There's so much there about the mistreatment and the evils, and but the rest of it, there's such a spirit of hope in those last few lines, and the idea of of moving forward, of searching for that happiness, but at the same time knowing that we must always be on guard for fear of, as it says, being deceived. And so excellent write and very well done.
Great insights, Pam. And Laurent, as our reader, I'll give you final word.
I've got to say, Pam's comment was outstanding. You're good, dear. You're good.
Absolutely.
I always read Deborah's poetry with anticipation and fear that I won't. My understanding will not measure up to her writing. But boy, oh boy, can she write! And this one is especially good. I was particularly struck by, "Will I howl when death steals my physical last breath? And if I do, will it be for fear or for joy? Or will I destroy any standing mention I once might have received? Or will I refrain for fear of being deceived?" She opens herself. She opens her past with a consummate ease, flaying readers' emotions with her howl of defiance. The abuse she suffered is part of her and informs her worldview and justifies her fears. This is a deeply personal write that really impacted this particular reader. I thought it was enviable writing.
Absolutely. Great comment. Okay, and with that, we are ready for our next one, Pam.
All right. A prayer. Oh, we are moving to our couple of carryovers from Melville. And the first one we have is... A Prayer Before the Pursuit by Bill Schiller, and it goes like this. I bumped down in gloom of a traveling ship's dim cabin, gathered with the hunk of a tattooed savage as our heads prepared recline on our narrow little beds. We took time to praise our gods. Instead, while unbridled waves tossed, I kissed my cross as Savage smiled at his graven wooden idol. In an uncertain hour before dawn, we pondered God's power but yawned. We gave thanks to God's mercy and righteous love that never fails, then delightfully slept with hope graced with violent dreams to assail. For tomorrow we might blessedly murder nature's great white whale. The savage is named Kigu. Call me Ishmael. With our captain, we make a great team of sailing infidels. End poem.
Great read, Pam. So yeah, so this was inspired by the quote, which was, okay, so as opposed to reading it, because it's kind of a long quote, the gist of it is, you know, that if I'm going to be a Christian, what is being a Christian? It's doing unto others as I would have them do unto me. So what would I want Quakequake to do is to worship in the great and righteous Protestant church like I worship. So therefore, if I'm going to be a good Christian, I've got to become an idolater and say my little prayers and prostrations in front of his wooden idol. And it's one of my favorite passages from Moby Dick. And I think that that Bill does tremendous justice to that prompt in this brevity. I thought it was a strong tribute poem that captures much of the aspirations and spirituality of the, excuse me, I'm fighting bronchitis, of the Ishmael's narrative and journey. Very nicely done. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Opening lines are outstanding. I bunked down in gloom of a traveling ship's dim cabin, gathered with a hunk of tattooed savage. Perfect. The line, we took time to praise our gods instead, I think goes back to what you were just talking about, and the uncertain hour before dawn in which they pondered God's power but yawned is an equally marvelous line. He pays strong homage to a powerful yet flawed source. But the character of Ishmael, however, is brilliantly captured by his words. Great write.
Great comment. And Pam, as reader, I'll give you final word.
All right. Well, I have to say that I thought this was a wonderful nod to not only the prompt, but to the characters and the idea, as you said, the treating others as you would have them treat you. I particularly liked the part, we gave thanks to God's mercy and righteous love that never fails, and delightfully slept with hope graced with violent dreams to assail. And I like that part, hope graced with violent dreams to assail, because it makes me think about the fact that no matter what our beliefs are, we all go through times of you know, hope and grace, but also times of violent dreams and fears. So excellent write and very well done.
Excellent comment, Pam. Okay, where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next, our last carryover is, all right, let's see here. Did I get it? Let me find out. Yes, I did. It is, let me find out what the title of that poem is, if it even has a title. It is a poem that has a title that I can't read, and it is by Mad Lad. And Richard, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
I see it. Yeah. I could be dead wrong, but I think this title is in Tibetan.
yeah.
I don't see the translation. Oh, here it is. Okay. I think it translates as, I'm looking at as his notes, give me rice. So,
okay.
It goes, yeah, it goes like this. Exactly 5 decades late to the 41 famine, I sit with 29 pigeons pecking at the absurd abundance of wheat left lying on marble floors of a closed-doors fancy restaurant, like bubbles cramped for space,
within sealed beer barrels. We squeeze and rub asses, hovering closer in quest of that singular golden grain. As I learn to calculate the infiniteness of everyone making up infinity, when has regular meals ever fetched authentic poetry? Then again, maybe God was made in Diogenes' image, his mistranslated template having the same problem to every symptom of a solution. Our truth, unconscious, only exists as a doubt, undecidable. So I let time stagnate in your womb before ripping the fibers off its face and dipping a pink straw into your empty socket where an eye should have been, but now is merely a skull castle for a lively moth couple. I suck out the memories of all you've seen. In the fossils of sweat salts, crystallized as diamonds, we pay the cost of many an unnamed holocaust. Yet, as death dish is too delicious to not try a bite, don't you think? I envy the unborn, and may my hay-hope stack in will orbits the elliptical dreams of this universe's fallen ethics while I walk the orbit of its missed signs. My utopia excludes every eye, hijacking the paralysis of historic relics. We linguify the void in our voice to catapult it back into the voidlessness of silence. And high on prison fog, I wind up my toy military to watch them fight off sharks in a swimming pool. I am too infantile to word my fantasies. End of poem. And Laurent, if we can start with you.
Yeah, what I drew from this was very much what was in the prompt. Our souls are like those orphans whose unwedded mothers die in bearing them. And if you think about it, it's absolutely true. This line here, and dipping a pink straw into your empty socket where an eye should have been, but is now merely a skull castle for a lively moth couple, I suck out the memories of all you've ever seen. You know, as I was reading this, I was kind of mesmerized by it, and yet, in a very strange way, hoping that it was over, but then it continued, and I was glad that it continued, and it kind of walked that walk at least several times. I love the line, "My utopia excludes every eye." I think that's fairly profound. This could also be a fairly difficult poem to really put into words because it's written in a way and structured in a way that really allows the mind to jump all over the place, grabbing at meanings. But wow, what a great piece.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you actually picked the passage that I thought as well was incredibly visceral and vivid in terms of its imagery. You know, that dipping the pink straw into your empty socket where an eye should have been. Ooh, like you kind of shiver when you feel it. It was a passage that almost hurt to read. And I agree also. I thought it was a tour de force of existential, spiritual journeying from the beer barrel to the eye socket. He bathes the mind in a torrent of surreal poetry that simultaneously made me scream for closure as well as for continuance. Very nicely done. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is just absolutely brilliant, powerful imagery and metaphors. You know, I really like how he does his spacing to give that idea of a sense of lingering over the stanzas. And there is this wonderful sense of searching for a truth, a philosophy that is oftentimes beyond us because we're, as it says, you know, too young You know, I am too infantile to word my fantasies, my desires, my needs. I also really liked hijacking the paralysis of historic relics. We lingify the void in our voice, catapulted back into the voidlessness of silence. And that is just, to me, a brilliant line on the idea of not learning necessarily from the past, even though we keep returning to it over and over again. So just an amazing write and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comments. Okay. And where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next, we have... Can't Start in the Middle by Darkened Auras. And Laurent, will you give that a read for us, please?
Certainly. Our stories never start as the action's taking place. It has to start before that, like a period of grace. If the boy who cried wolf began with the chase, everyone would seem heartless, ignoring the fear on his face. Since it began earlier, when he lied over and over, it showed they'd not be fooled by this cover. Now that it was true, now that it was real, they had a reason to doubt. This was the real deal. Like every good tale, we need the full story. Can't start at the middle and not have a worry. With each little detail that is left out, it really does change what the story is about. End poem.
Great read, Laurent. And Pam, if we could start comments with you. What'd you think?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, great read. And wonderful rhyming poem, had a great meter to it. I really like how this speaks on the technicalities of writing, but it also speaks on the way of about learning from life. You know, I like how there's this idea of how important it is that there be certain steps in storytelling in order to glean knowledge and wisdom from the words, but also that in order for us to fully learn from life, it has to progress in a natural order. So really great write and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. Yeah, I too really like this piece. And it was based on the quote, which was, literature was not born on the day when a boy crying wolf, wolf, came running out of the Neanderthal Valley with a big gray wolf at his heels. Literature was born of the day when the boy came crying, wolf, wolf, and there was no wolf behind him. And I liked what he did with it. It read like a children's fable and matched well with that given prompt of the boy crying wolf. The fable-like vibe was reinforced by the rhyming scheme. That was a great add to our Nabokov night, especially given Nabokov's kind of what I'm looking for. I guess self-awareness. A lot of writers are just really into the craft of storytelling, but I think Nabokov is coming out of that early part of postmodernism, where there's a great emphasis on self-referencing and looking at what writing is. And I thought that this captured that in a very kind of clever way. And with that, your thoughts, Laurent?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with the last stanza. With each little detail that is left out, it really does change what the story is about. Because the story that begins on page one is different by page 10, is different again with each added detail, each justification, each introduction of a new character or a circumstance. So yes, literature was not born the day when a boy crying wolf came running out of the valley. It is very well done.
Absolutely, yeah. So, and Pam, I'm guessing there was some kind of technical thing, but we fixed it, right?
The labeling, I didn't get a chance to do that.
No. I was wondering what you were you...
Oh, Lawrence had been in the room that he dropped, so I was going to say you have to pick him up.
Yes.
But he obviously,
Yeah, we're all so skilled with this board that we correct problems as they arise. Part of the magic of radio right here for you guys.
Okay. Yeah, there's a massive burst of static, and I was gone.
Yep.
Yeah, it happened. Yep. Okay, so with that, I see you've put the next poem on, and this one actually has a SoundCloud so we can all rest our voices for a couple minutes. This is Eric Svensson's Chrysalis. Let me play the SoundCloud.
Chrysalis, eye of horror's butterfly, flies ping-pong ball light, settles down, marble secure, next to honey spoon drip, wings adroitly namaste, then proboscis unfolds to sip and ad-lib. Howdy, Chrysalis, just dropped in for some sweetness. I look around dumbfounded. Yes, you, honey child, in turns radiant butterfly. Chrysalis, I'm human. That's what you all say. Proboscis merrily detects, directs, digests. How come? It came about when you were born. Before then, you too were a winged ethereal being like me. Pinball light, filled with glorious ineffable light. You don't say, gosh, what happened then? Well, prophet the delicate eye of Horus fellow. When you were birthed into this realm and died, your chrysalis began forming itself around you. The process is still happening as you sit here before me. I scratched my head, waited, scratched my chin. Finally, I cleared my throat. So, what say you, contemplating chrysalis? Do you get my drift? Not quite, I wave my white flag, reply. When you're born to die in this realm, your wings get clipped. While imprisoned in the illusion of life, the chrysalis is forming around you. Only when you are reborn back into the realm of living spirit from whence you came in the first place, do your newer and stronger wings open up again. Once again, you can ping-pong ball hop around in even higher, glorious, ineffable, light-filled realms. Sir, you're saying I'm dead now? The butterfly gently winked the eye of Horus at me 7 times. No, my sweetest honey child. A chrysalis is very much alive, albeit appearing to be in stasis. Think about that. Over 7 billion chrysalis beings getting ready to be birthed back into the living realms of spirit. So, I retorted happily, exactly how far am I in my process? before I'm free to fly again. Well, sweet pea, you'll only be ready to fly back home when I can appear before you in my entire angelic form, without you being incinerated by the light. Until then, my humble butterfly vibration will have to suffice. End poem.
Wow. Thank you for the SoundCloud, Eric. Boy, what a wonderful metaphor for spiritual evolution. What a wonderful storytelling poem on the nature of spiritual evolution. Just a real strong piece and quite appropriate given that Nabokov studied butterflies and was a famous kind of collector of butterflies. The whole thing was just so strong, and there was a part that I outlined in my comments, and when I heard Eric reciting the poem and was reading along the second time, this other part kind of struck me. When you're born to die in this realm, your wings get clipped. While imprisoned in the illusion of life, the chrysalis is forming around you. Only when you are reborn back into the realm of living spirit, from whence you came in the first place, do your newer and stronger wings open up again. Once again, you can ping-pong ball hop around in even higher, glorious, ineffable, light-filled realms. And it's interesting because, you know, we all have our own ideas about the meaning of life and the afterlife. But it's so compelling, the vision that he gives us in this poem. It's such a gift. And, you know, during darker moments of anguish and suffering that entails, you know, it's part and parcel of the human experience, remembering some of this stuff, I think, kind of helps put it in perspective. So I am truly appreciative of the effort. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to say that in your comment, I liked how you used the phrase spiritual evolution. And I had the same thought, although, you know, obviously I replaced evolution with growth since, you know, I go for simpler words. But, you know, I really liked this all the way through. I like how he was inspired by Nabokov's love of the butterfly and created a story type, right, where we see this interaction between this butterfly and this human. And there was nice little touches here, like where the butterfly says, "Yes, you, honey child," in tones radiant butterfly. There's such a, like the idea of using a butterfly, using the phrase honey child, it almost like the butterfly becomes a mother figure. And the raw and childlike honesty, and you don't say, gosh, what happened then? And the answer given, and the idea as that idea of spiritual growth, and, you know, how eventually that growth will lead us into an existence of light when we can see fully that incinerated by the light. Until then, my humble butterfly vibrations will have to suffice. So until we can fully see what is offered up in heaven, we must see the spiritual with those things that are here upon the earth. So excellent write and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. And Laurent, your thoughts?
My thought is that following the two of you in comments on this show is among the more difficult of tasks, but I will attempt something. The whole concept of a birth, life, existence, death, and rebirth is fascinatingly treated in this particular poem, this unfinished masterpiece, which is this future life of rebirth. And I can see how it's very deeply spiritual, yet is it also deeply spiritual to the butterfly? It's a biological process, scientifically oriented, yet we can't help but treat it as spiritual, especially if we are a person of faith. But if you're not a person of faith, it can be equally enjoyed. Really a brilliant little piece.
Great comment there, Laurent. Okay, Pam, where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next, we have Thinkers Have Diaries and Legal Pads by Becky Upchurch. And Richard, will you give that a read for us, please?
Sure. So this is Thinkers Have Diaries and Legal Pads by Becky Upchurch, and it goes like this. Then I was so low, weak, I licked the hardwood of any man's floor-ed ideal, wondering what their ceiling beams taste like. Would they splinter and bleed my tongue of flavorful, artful words, or put lift in the moping stillness of me? A low, weak wannabe poet, desiring all hardwood be unprocessed and raw, uncut and green and supple and innocently upright. What are our ceiling beams really for? My diary, half-assed summations, adding emotion to day's robotic action, my ceiling beam, blocking my organic exploits like dead stars they were, void of feelings. I needed to feel all of my emotions in one breath before a black hole sucked them dry. Footnote. Listen, learn in class, act in society, write thoughts in front of your steps. Think, as Mama always said. P.S. or footnote, who cares? End of poem. Okay, Laurent, I'll give you first crack at this one.
Thank you so much. I enjoy Becky's poetry. This is a good example of why she's such a good poet. A low, weak, wannabe poet, desiring all the hardwood be unprocessed and raw, uncut and green and supple and innocently upright. What are ceiling beams really for? This is a person who learns, who matures, if you will, and is never really satisfied that they are aware of everything around them, or that they interpret it appropriately, or that you can be suddenly happy for no reason whatsoever. And yet, with wishes, with half-assed summations, adding emotions to day's robotic action, which she says is her ceiling beam. Excellent piece.
Great comment. Yeah, and I totally agree. She is incredibly talented, and it comes through in this poem particularly. It's an incredibly strong confessional, right? It has that kind of existential vibe to it. The metaphors take on almost mythic qualities. Quite powerful throughout. I love the ceiling beams and the licking of the hardwood floors, and it's just so visceral. And you kind of feel it in your bones. And then the footnote at the end, P.S. or footnote, who cares? That whole existential takeaway at the end, I thought was really just a great ending. It's going to be a tough one to judge in this contest. And Pam, I'll give you final word.
All right. Well, this is definitely a powerful rite. Amazing imagery and metaphors. I like how the main idea I get is that the idea of the importance of scribbling the footnotes, scribbling to and to process and to help us learn to think for ourselves. There's something in this rite that in its own delicate way is quite a feminist rite in the idea of a woman who learns to think beyond the ceilings offered up by mankind. And I love the question by men and people in general. And I love the question, what are ceiling beams really for? Are they for holding up ceilings? Are they, you know, metaphorically, you know, are they something, like oftentimes people who declare that they're trying to keep us safe are really trying to keep us controlled. I really liked the idea of I needed to feel all of my emotions in one breath before a black hole sucked them dry. An amazing rite and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. Okay, and where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next we have Invention of Lies by Anton Ansford, and it goes like this. A billion or so years ago, I was teaching English in a language school in Auckland, though not to the same degree as the borderline racism of the English TV show. National tendencies existed. Parisian French, including Moroccan and other immigrants, tended to be condescending and arrogant, the women chortling away at the slightest hint of eroticism, while the island French tended to be calm and kind. The Brazilians wore as few clothes as possible and undulated as they walked, loved parties, and had a flexible attitude to time. Churchill used to talk about someone who was economical with the truth. One of my favorite students was mine. A delicate beauty who was not so much economical with the truth as creative with it. The old excuse, a dog ate my homework, was far too prosaic for her. Instead, a squadron of golden butterflies alighted on her homework, transformed it into a silver pirate ship, and it floated away. When asked how she was, she would claim that her left arm had transmogrified into a swan's wing, but apart from that, she was fine. Her grammar and understanding were fine, and she didn't seem to have any mental problems, so I had to assume that a kind of magic realism had infused her speech. This tendency wasn't noticed by me alone. One lesson, when the class was asked what describes you in one word, she answered sincere with a beautiful smile. The class fell about laughing. I am happy to say she sweetly smiled. End poem.
Great read, Pam. I thought this was a wonderful character portrayal of May. We all know this kind of archetypal teller of tall tale. And I think Anton brought her to life quite skillfully, endearingly. We certainly are rooting for her, and it wasn't lost on me that a squadron of butterflies, you know, was right there up the Nabokov trail. So very well done. And Laurent, your thoughts?
What seems laughable to the crowd is laudable to the poet, who speaks with a kind of magic about life, and nothing is ever prosaic. And then what Anton calls magic realism had infused her speech. And then to answer sincere to the question of how she should be described generates laughter, but she is that person who will just sweetly smile knowing who she is and not particularly caring about what anyone else thinks, just being herself. As you said, a very, very strong character portrayal.
Excellent comment. And Pam, I'll give you final word. What do you think?
Yeah, I thought this was an amazing write. I like how he goes into this story, this description of his characters. And I did not know that that was pronounced May. I was pronouncing it Mai, like Mai Tai, because instantly I thought of the nice fruity drink. But no, I really liked this. And I like how it is about those people, someone who thinks differently, the magic of imagination and the importance of finding our wings that pulls us out of the box. And as Lawrence said, there's really this great idea of someone who is completely sincere in who they are, you know, and doesn't really care what necessarily other people think. So excellent write and very well done.
And yeah, Pam, you could be right. I was just guessing at the pronunciation as well.
I thought it was a character from one of Nabokov's books, and you just knew it.
Oh.
Okay.
No, not at all. I just have a Chinese friend whose name is Mei, and it's spelled M-E-I, so I thought maybe it was the same pronunciation. I'm not sure. It's a coin toss. So
there you go.
You definitely could have gotten it right.
Six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Yeah. Where would you like to go?
All right. Well, Lawrence, I've gone ahead and put your poem up, so go ahead and give it a read for us, please.
All right. Now, even though the title was Breaking Waves, I had changed it to Straight Jackets in Vivo, so it is the correct poem. Let me reverberate. Allow me to shake doubters from their sleepy drowse. As a darting butterfly does not hint at the stag, nor a lion, dancing ballet of sparks, corded sinew of the blacksmith. His hammer knows only the anvil. The ballet master knows beauty, but his world is a wooden stage, and beauty's performance his to judge. One's personal cosmos is not the universe entire. Pretensions to the contrary are, while hopelessly compelling, regretful. Young soldier falls, wondering why he can't get up, marveling at the moment before sleep eases pain. He is ushered into the past. There are no alternatives. Leave death blameless, as it knows no other way. Lethe employs no half measures, provides no moral education, simply cessation, oblivion on the half shell as aperitif, a body received. We are the crowd. Mob strength infuses each with a voice stronger than his own. Our world slowly slips away as we become the beast that paws the ground, snorting its displeasure. Offenders tossed high on our horns, landing broken and twisted, torn by the gale, crushed by the rapture of moral indignation, outraged, carved from nostalgia for a mythical past, a shroud of conceit, woven with a golden thread of imagination. Straight jackets in vivo. End poem.
Wow. What an amazing poem. So just the references, it's so deep and powerful, so emotive, just jaw-droppingly good. I especially like crushed by the rapture of moral indignation, outrage, carved from nostalgia for a mythical past. There's just so much to this. And you really bring us into a space or invite us into a space. And it's like a slice of life. It's got the, you know, the agony and the ecstasy all rolled in, literary illusions galore. It's just very, very powerful, very well done piece. And Pam, absolutely. Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is brilliant. It's absolutely amazing with its imagery and metaphors. I really like what you had to say there, Richard. And, you know, I liked that there is this idea of being asleep and, you know, kind of like being oblivious to the idea of half-truth. And there's something in it that speaks in the ethical fabrics of society. But the main message I get, especially if it gives a different example of the butterfly and the lamb and lion and the blacksmith and the ballet master, is we all have our small sections of life that we live. But they're important to us, but they're small pieces of a much grander puzzle. I also particularly like how you mentioned leave death blameless as it knows no other way. You know, death is death. You know, the river Lethe is the river Lethe. You know, time and memories lost and life lost is all part of that cycle that we unfortunately deal with. And I also really like crushed by the rapture of moral indignation, outrage carved from nostalgia for a mythical past. I like how those lines speak on the idea that morals weren't necessarily better off in the past as they are now. You know, excellent write and very well done.
Thank you, Pam.
Great comment, Pam. Okay, where would you like to go next?
All right. Well, up next, I have your poem, Richard. So go ahead and give it a read for us, please.
Okay. So, yeah, you know, the funny thing is that when you think of Nabokov, you think of Lolita, and I was tempted to try some type of riffing off of that novel, just because it's so, you know, just such an icon of modern literature. But in reading through the prompts, I found this quote from the novel Mary, and it's nostalgia in reverse, the longing for yet another strange land grew especially strong in spring. And as a result, it kind of inspired me to write the following. It's called Another Strange Land. Eyes wide shut, chest hollowed out, rhythmic drumming echoed the right, left, right beat of the heart's chambers, breathing slowed. Swirling light and trance descended through hollow of the ancient crabapple tree, down through rich gold coast soil into another land. The Looney Tune cartoon raccoon approached. You can't be my power animal. You're a cartoon. She laughed and turned real while giving suck to her litter. I kept on. Are you? I am the gatekeeper. Through me, this lower world unfurls. I bowed low and thanked Rocky Raccoon. Just as a black, paper-thin bat's wing winded my eyes. Are you? I've waited many years for this day. A wavy-haired, blue-eyed child left us all those years back. Now a balding old man has returned. You're Batty. I remember you from childhood dreams. dreams? Batty laughed. You've been dreaming your life away. Praise Apollo and Helios for finally waking you. The drumbeat quickened. Rocky smiled wide while singing as he figurated my head. Return to sender. For now, hurry back before the drumbeat stops. How can I climb back up in time? Batty snorted. Time? Then winged us north through the roots of that old crabapple tree at light speed, just as the drumbeat died. End of poem. I'll give you the reins. I apologize.
I forgot.
That's okay.
Yes, I completely forgot. So let's go ahead and start with your thoughts, Lawrence.
Sefton Mall. As you descended to the hollow of the ancient crabapple tree into that other land, that strange land that you returned to by time winging us north, and for north I see up through the roots of that old crabapple tree at light speed, just as a drumbeat died. You know, I read that. And a thousand thoughts went through my mind about how you handled that bit of arriving in that place and leaving that place through the encounter of your spirit animal. When you say dreams, Batty laughed, you've been dreaming your life away. Praise Apollo and Helios for finally waking you. The drumbeat quickened. Rocky smiled wide while singing, as you figure-ated my head, that's beautifully phrased, return to sender, for now, hurry back before the drumbeat stops. You employ symbols and imagery, and you marry them in this dreamlike state of being. Your created characters are deftly handled, ushering in that strange land and making it relatable in the oddest of ways. A peculiar shining of light's dark past we share that sometimes illuminates our path, leading us to a spirit animal. Now, I've yet to make that journey, but hope to one day. I thought this expressed a wonderful attention to the prompt as well as being somewhat mesmerizing. Really enjoyed this.
Thanks so much, Lauren.
Great comment there, Lauren. And, yeah, I really enjoyed this one. This one was one that the write itself and your performance of it made me smile. It actually, besides being a great take on the chosen prompt, it reminded me of a quote that I remember Rex had in one of his contests that said, what I say might be profane, but it is also profound. Because to me, you have such a wonderful use of humor in this. To make a profound message of the idea of the twisting and turning and the blur between reality and dreams. And I like how this takes a look at the idea of those childhood memories, those childhood dreams following us into adulthood and becoming those lessons that we learned. I love the use of dialogue, the interaction between the character and the spirit animals, and just an excellent write, very well done. And just so you know, I now have the song Rocky Raccoon going through my head as an earworm. So, yeah, thanks for that. Great right there, Richard.
Thanks so much, Pam. Okay, where would you like to go next?
All right, well, up next, I'll go ahead and give my poem a read. And this is Wastelands of Worms and Wings by moi. And it goes like this. Wastelands echoing screams of once upon a time, shattering and scattered to the four winds. I covet stars in their silence, wishing I didn't remember the stench of sweat in the forearm of rancid cocoons. where baby worms die in a spittle of shame, blaming no one but themselves for the wounds of moths that never learned the wings of trust. The soil is planted with rosemary and thyme, sold to the highest bidder in a spree of crimes to the mind. Betrayal flaying, the melancholy split of footsteps falling to the platter of a monster's bread, savored and devoured. No more will tar cling to the bones of a past dug up, wiped clean by the shedding of tears. In the lyrics of a truth sinking and rising in the bile of karma, still seeped and seated in the peaking of white noise, to exploit the warehouse of hell brought to innocence reinvented, the viral pride of skeletons that hang themselves upon the grief poked and prodded, the shaken core of a harvest foundation where slithered the slime, a veiled consumption of flesh seen and approved by those who protect their own but never the bloom of an outsider, planted unwilling beneath hypocrisy seeds to grow the stem bent to kiss the weight of a cross upon shoulders too young to bear the secrets told by the hiss of vipers in the nest called for home, walked away from, and poem.
Great read, Pam. So, yeah, I love this one. This one was, you know, it just struck me there was so much here. And a second read, I actually got even more from. There was a lot of autumnal symbolism that I didn't catch the first time around. The shaken core of a harvest foundation where slithered the slime. And even I kind of thought that the skeleton was hearkening to autumnal themes, in particular Halloween. So all that just shows you how rich this piece is, that it was stuff I didn't get the first read round. I thought simultaneously existential and sublimely spiritual and heavily laden with archetypal symbols like the vipers and the cross. And I especially like to grow the stem bent to kiss the weight of a cross upon shoulders too young to bear the secrets told by the hiss of vipers in the nest called the home walked away from. Really great piece, Pam.
Thank you very much.
And, oh, absolutely. And Laurent, your thoughts?
May I say that Wastelands of Worms and Wings is among the better alliterative titles I have ever read. When you say Wastelands echoing screams of once upon a time, shattering and scattered to the four winds. Once upon a time, of course, is how any number of fairy tales begin. And to me, those are happy words. And yet, in your voice, it suggests a youth that was very unhappy. A cocoon, which should be nurturing, is instead remembered for the stench of sweat in the forearm of rancid cocoons where baby worms die in a spittle of shame, blaming no one but themselves. How often do children not blame themselves for something that is inflicted painfully so by the parent or the caretaker? And even though you plant with rosemary and thyme, it is simply to be sold to the highest bidder. No more will tar cling to the bones of a past dug up, wiped clean by the shedding of tears. And here we have the child growing up, I think, gaining confidence, understanding what happened in the past, and is not going to shed any more tears because the bones of the past have been wiped clean. The viral pride of skeletons that hang themselves upon the grief poked and prodded is again a suggestion of the past being a skeleton upon which we hang ourselves, which is the opposite of what should happen. To grow the stem bent to kiss the weight of a cross upon shoulders too young to bear the secrets told by the hiss of vipers in the nest called the home walked away from. Those last three lines are wonderful because we now have the individual leaving that nest of vipers that used to be home, that we are now old enough to leave and build our own life. I guess you could say that these are all footnotes to a vast, obscure, unfinished masterpiece, which is our lives. Just a very profound piece, and it really grabbed a deep part of me and is not letting go. And the imagery was evocative, filled with truths that apply to all of us, yet in context, only to you. Marvelous poem, Pam.
Thank you, Laurent.
Excellent comment there, Laurent. You caught so much of what was embedded in the text. Just very skillful. And with that, we're ready for our next one. Where would you like to go, Pam?
Up next we have When the Salt Trucks by Naomi Sarah, and we have a recording for that.
We do. Let me get it.
I am here through an error, not in this prison specifically, but in this whole terrible striped world. Vladimir Nabokov. When the salt trucks. When the salt trucks dump Main Street into its gutters, I will no longer have reason to stay there in the doorway where no one kisses anymore. To all my hollowed-out hopes, to my remnants of old centuries, I leave my keys. I hang my skates on the edge of the ramp and let them be taken. The sun rises to no end. In the distance, I stare into the dance of falling snowflakes, catch one on my tongue, only to feel die. The stretch of sky has faded into a dirty white. The buildings look like disco balls dressed in dated, sequined dresses. And I try to redraw the landscape, my tired face condemned by the day. Twist my lips into a smile to tear out its light, to make fake jewels out of it, to decorate my world.
Great sound, Cloud, Naomi. Pam, I'll give you first word.
All right. Well, this is beautifully written. I love how she uses simple language, but in a way that digs deep and rich into imagery and metaphors. I thought this was a beautiful look at the season of winter as an extended metaphor, how it balances out beauty and ugliness, and we see both sides of it as we stand in that doorway and try to take it all in. And I really thought this was a wonderful representation of what life is. It's the beauty, but soon we realize the beauty and the shining is nothing but fake jewels offered up. And, you know, wonderful lines. And I particularly like, to all my hollowed out hopes, to my remnants of old centuries, I leave my keys, I hang my skates on the edge of the ramp and let them be taken. And the part about the stretch of sky has faded to a dirty white, the buildings look like disco balls dressed in dated sequin dresses. Wonderful lines, beautifully written and very well done.
Absolutely great comment. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a person who has really become tired of a life perhaps without meaning. To all my hollowed out hopes, to my remnants of old centuries, I leave my keys. I hang my skates on the edge of the ramp and let them be taken. You know, when you hang your skates up, you kind of come to the end of a career. You come to the end of a life. The sun rises to no end. The new day does not bring anything that is going to be very, very special. And even though one can admire the dance of falling snowflakes, if you do manage to catch it, you're only going to feel it die, almost as if to say, what's the use? And I try to redraw the landscape, my tired face condemned by the day. And what can you do with it but twist your lips into a smile to somehow make it better? As she says, to make fake jewels out of it, to decorate my world, which needs color so badly. A very melancholy, pensive poem that illustrates the imagination of a person who is not at all like the person in the poem.
Great comment there, Laurent. Yeah. I love the chosen Nabokov quote, which, you know, and we encourage that, is to find other quotes beyond whatever. I usually do somewhere between 10 and 14. And the one that she chose, I am here through an error, not in this prison specifically, but in this whole terrible striped world. And it reminded me not only of the Nabokov quote regarding prison and the world, but also of, you know, Hamlet, where he says Denmark's a prison. And sometimes life really feels that. And I kind of got that vibe throughout. The similes and metaphors were stunning, conveying that prison vibe so well. I especially liked, I try to draw the landscape, my tired face condemned by the day, twist my lips into a smile, tear out its light, make fake jewels out of it, decorate my world. Painfully beautiful is the phrase that comes to mind. Very well done, Naomi. So much for bringing it to us. And with that, turning it back to you, Pam, for our next one.
All right. Up next, we have Be Still by Weaver of Dreams, and we have a recording for that one.
Yep, let me pull it. Okay, that is the second one.
Be still for a moment. Can you sense anything? I'm standing beside you. Can't you hear me? Look into your mirror. Don't you see that haze hovering around, enveloping you? That's me. Being nebulous is fine if you don't want to make an impression on the world that you're caught up in. But I want to leave my mark, have my words heard. I need your eyes, hands, and voice to convey them. Channel me. Only give me a day. I'll wear you as if you were an haute couture garment. No answer. I feared that. I must accept that I'm missed in misery. My truth will die with me because no one can hear.
Great sound cloud there, Weaver. And if we could start comments with Laurent.
I don't want to say an odd poem. It's wonderfully different. It pretends. All right, look, I better start over again here. We have a voice that is not heard. Words that nobody hears. Not because she's actually any kind of a misty ghost, but she's so ineffectual and being able to communicate what is inside of her, that she seems like a haze, or she seems like a nebulous being that you you can easily miss. This being unable to leave her mark, she needs total cooperation of the other individual or of society in general. I need your eyes, hands, and voice to convey them. And, you know, just give me the chance. Channel me. Only give me a day. I love the phrase, I'll wear you as if you were an haute couture garment. But no answer comes back. She's still missed in misery. My truth will die because no one can hear. But why can't anyone hear her? Is the fault with the listener or the non-listener? Is the fault with the person trying to express themselves? You're kind of caught between both ends. I really liked it a great deal. And it leaves me feeling at odds. Not as an odd poem, but it leaves me feeling at odds almost with myself, because I don't know whether it's the person trying to express or the person who can't hear because they don't listen. Great piece.
Yeah, I agree. Great insights there, Laurent. It is the paradox, you know, it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And just so that everyone has, we're all on the same page, this is prompt 7. I need you, the reader, to imagine us, for if we don't really exist, if you don't. And that puts us squarely into that, you know, tree falls in the forest, nobody's there to hear it, did it really fall? And it's the tension between the creator and the audience. And it's a tough thing. I've struggled with this my entire career of writing is, you know, am I doing this to get it out? Or am I doing this because I need that audience? I need someone to understand what I'm trying to communicate. And I think it's more important to explore the tension than it is to come up with a black, white, either or answer. And I think that is explored quite intelligently in this brevity. I thought it was a wonderful riffing off of the prompt, exploring who we are without the reader, the audience. And I liked the metaphor, the ghost, the ghostly subtext. I thought it was a really, as you stated, Laurent, was a very skillful way of introducing the problem, introducing the conflict, the tension. So quite a lot accomplished in this brevity. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought this was an amazing story, both a story and an extended metaphor. I like what you both had to say. And, you know, this is a particularly intriguing and creative right on the idea of those voices, those people that need to be heard or not, you know, or have to be heard because they have a message of importance to pass along. And yet so oftentimes the most important messages are the ones that fall on deaf ears. I was particularly fond of the line, being nebulous is fine if you don't want to make an impression on the world. And then, like Laurent, I also really like channel me, only give me a day, I'll wear you as if you were the haute couture garment. And so excellent write and very well done.
Great comments. And where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next, we have Flight of Imagination in the Mind by Lord of Beads and Laurent. Will you give that a read for us, please?
Righto. The feather of imagination ignited. The bird of imagination is invited. The phoenix appears and takes flight. I'm under the shadow of Ferdowsky's copyright. Without imagination and creativity, everything will become a banality. Please, be the avid readers to imagine us, 'cause without you, we are completely lost. End poem.
Nicely read there, Laurent. Yeah, you know, I didn't come across the first time I read this, but the second read, I kind of got the humor of it. Tongue-in-cheek humor. And the humor is really in the rhymes, I felt. Especially, I'm under the shadow of Ferdowsky's copyright. And I like the backstory of the s'mores and the burning of his feathers. Nabokov was played with the dance between creator and audience, and your rhyming brevity, and his or her rhyming brevity captured that interplay quite skillfully, I felt. So very, very nicely done. And like I said, I like the humor, but I didn't necessarily catch the first time that I read this. So there's a lot there. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is definitely a wonderful rhyming brevity. Some great alliteration. I admit to not fully getting the reference to I'm under the shadow of Ferdowsky's copyright because I don't really know who Ferdowsky is. But I got the general gist of it, because to be under the shadow of a copyright is the idea of, you know, not having your own unique voice or feeling like you don't, to me anyways. I did love the use of the word banality, and I did enjoy how, you know, that this is the idea of getting away from the idea of group thinking. So excellent write and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. And Laurent, your thoughts?
Yes, I was. I am so sorry.
It's okay.
This poem really underscores the need to believe at certain times. Maybe the suspension of disbelief, which is not an uncommon way of describing how one enjoys fantasy or science fiction. And Ferdowsky apparently is this legend of Zal and Simorg, where you're basically unappreciated at home. You leave to grow up and succeed. Your parents then come for you, and he who has taken care of you then lets you go home. But, you know, if you ever need me, give me a call. Here are three feathers, etc. And so when he says, I'm under the shadow of Ferdowsky's copyright, it's those first three lines that refer to the AN so cleverly. But it still threw me a little bit to the loop, because that's a lot of explanation for what I thought was a relatively understandable and uncomplicated poem about the importance of imagination and how it's treated at a young age and then at an older age. Very nice, very nicely done. I don't know if I made any sense.
No, absolutely you did. And yeah, there is definitely this referencing to this legend, which I had never heard before, the legend, but I liked it immediately when I read the AN. So. Yeah, great job. And we're ready for our next one. Where would you like to go?
Right. Up next, we have An Owl's Ballad, number 5, by Jack Blue. And Richard, will you give that a read for us, please?
Sure. Okay, so this is Jack Blue. It's called An Owl's Ballad, number 5. On the bleak, uncanny beach, almost every moonless night, something like a lute resounds through the reminiscences, lingering in purple minor on the muddy blue vein. How many lonely melodies of sorrow, madness, or despair blink adrift around the sea or in the liquid purgatory where the sunken souls enjoy an eternal reverie. The water swallowing the fate of shadowy, ambitious oars or repentant, righteous swords never brings their souls home if the bluish requiem waves to infinity. May the sweet vein inspire every nymph of sapphire when the violet melodies, born anew from ancient stories, recall another universe enveloped in the endless curse in poem. And Pam, if we can start comments with you.
Yeah, this is beautiful. You know, Jack Blue always has a way with imagery and colors. And, you know, there's a certain almost peacefulness to this, and yet with lines like liquid purgatory and madness of despair, you know, there's the idea of the turmoils of life. I like how this uses the idea of water, the sea, as and its depth and expansion as almost like a metaphor for how we really can't take all of life in. And I really like the line, the water swallowing the fate of a shadow, ambitious oars, a repentant, righteous sword never brings their souls home if the bluish requiem waves to infinity. Wonderful lines there, beautifully written and very well done.
Great comment. And Laurent, your thoughts?
The language in this particular poem is especially beautiful. How many lonely melodies of sorrow, madness, or despair blink adrift around the sea or the liquid purgatory where the sunken souls enjoy an eternal reverie. This poem speaks to the interconnectedness of an unrecognizing universe, almost. Each of us so fixated on ourselves that we have difficulty doing anything but concentrating on that, and you can't just see one thing and deduce everything from it. You have to go abroad, you have to enjoy the context, you have to see what's going on, and this slow dance, this sweet pavane inspires violet melodies born in you from ancient stories. Recall another universe enveloped in the endless curse, that curse of not knowing and not being aware of. It's not a lyrical piece in, exactly, but it has something of that rhythm, if you will. Wonderfully done.
Great comment. Yeah, I agree. It has the rhythm, and I think that speaks to the text itself. That, you know, he's giving us a glimpse of the sea, and so it's rhythmic, just like the waves on the ocean. Where that was my hit on it. I thought it was jaw-droppingly good. The pathos of mankind lost in the vastness of the sea was striking. It hit like a primordial note at the unconscious. And one of the things that both Neutron and I really like about Jack Blue is that when we write comments, he'll, instead of saying thanks or nice, you know, I appreciate it, he'll actually go into great depth. So I'll read his comment, too. When I wrote that, he said, Nabokov's word on the marine infinity with a reminiscence of Melville's solitude magically took me to a Japanese medieval legend retold marvelously by Hearn, where the sunken souls or the armored shadows desire to hear the blind priest's lute waving hard on the nocturnal water in quest of redemption or consolation. A little more color to it through his note. And with that, we're ready for our next one.
All right. Up next we have, hold on, I got to check something. Okay, I am unmuted. All right. Up next we have The Tales of Promise by S. Sharp. And it goes like this. Chaos reigns here on the scorched side of the earth, in the ashes of humanity under the shadow sky, where the smoke from the moon can be seen for millions of miles in all directions and dimensions. Clouds form from the sizzling seas, rising into the dark fluorescence of permanent night, where voids have voids, tears in the fabric of promise, black holes in conscience, devour any remnants of hope left from the old books, tales emblazoned upon our hearts by our forefathers, and poem.
Great read, Pam. Laurent, if we can start with you.
I love how well connected the two stanzas are in this. Chaos reigns here on the scorched side of the earth in the ashes of humanity under the shadow sky. To me, jumps directly to a line in the second stanza, tears in the fabric of promise, black holes in conscience. When you look at the title, The Tales of Promise, and see it followed immediately by the two words, chaos reigns, it immediately tells you that the tales have not borne fruit. We have not fulfilled the promise. I love the line where the smoke from the moon, and of course the moon has no smoke on it, but it's the smoke that you see in the moonlight from the fires on the scorched side of the earth. The poem is so evocative, so quickly, so well written. It really is a little gem.
Absolutely, great comment. Yeah. I, too, really like this, and this was another one where the second read, I found other parts that really struck me that I hadn't noticed as much the first time around. I love the line, rising into the dark fluorescence of permanent night where voids have voids. It's, you know, it's just quite dark, you know, literally and figuratively as well. And I thought it was indicative of just strong imagery throughout, highly emotive. The brevity accomplishes much with very few lines, reminiscent of classical Japanese paintings where the artist conveys so much with a single brushstroke. That's what it reminded me of. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is an excellent dark brevity. It really did have powerful imagery. I really like how, to me, it spoke on the idea that the dark fabric of history that creates holes and promises made. And I particularly like the line, clouds form from the sizzling seas rising in the dark fluorescence of permanent night. Wonderful lines and very well done.
Absolutely great comment, Pam. Okay, and where would you like to go next?
All right, up next we have Nothing Behind You by Sucker for the Treadmill. And Laurent, will you give that a read for us, please?
With pleasure. Nothing behind you. Crying out, a voice of what it must be to witness a cloud and purpose a raspberry's taste. It tastes like a cloud could. You feel the fog roll in, begin to curdle, feed, a call, trying to know them in a realm the sweat sullies. You want to take this air in. You want to die alone. But he releases you to sniff the fog. You want to belong where you're alone. A form extends from your chest. It is water held by a cosmic force, telling you to bury the horns in mounds on a farm where they trace your skin, lacing your wounds carried into any light. It tells you. It understands. As winds cover your face, fly your feet to conceal any unworthiness into the earth. End poem.
Great read, Laurent. To me, this felt like a deeply spiritual poem, working through and then transcending trauma. Especially like, as wings cover your face, fly your feet to conceal any unworthiness into the earth. And especially those lines kind of reminded me of the metaphor of the lotus, that the lotus is supposed to be, in the East, a metaphor for humanity, that we're, our roots are in the muck, and we ascend towards the sky, towards the heavens. So I thought it was very well done. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, I really liked and appreciated this one. It has such a unique imagery to it, the very creative. I like what you had to say about it being a spiritual rite. And I could, after you said that, I could see it. I particularly, liked and purpose a raspberry's taste. It tastes like a cloud could. And your skin lacing your wounds carried into any light. It tells you it understands. To me, besides the healing part, the idea of healing, there's also this idea of soaring towards new ways of thinking, which I think is a part of healing. So excellent write and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. And Laurent, as reader, I'll give you a final word.
Yeah, when you have a title like Nothing Behind You, in the context of the write, I begin to think about, nothing behind you, nothing that I came from. I came from nothing. Or where I came from was unimportant. At least that's what I took from the title. Now, I was most impressed by the stanza that you had chosen, Richard, and then the first two stanzas, crying out a voice of what it must be to witness a cloud and purpose a raspberry's taste. It tastes like a cloud could. Now, oddly enough, this does not feel like a spiritual poem to me. Rather, a poem of reason and self-understanding. It speaks of a cosmic force, and it speaks of winds that cover your face and fly your feet to conceal any unworthiness into the earth. Were you capable enough to do what you wished to accomplish despite all the crap that happened beforehand? And Pam, you called this beautiful, filled with thoughtful imagery. I got to agree with you.
Great insights. Okay, so where would you like to go next, Pam?
All right, our next poem is Poetry of Graffiti by Kay Crown. And Richard, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
Okay. So this is Poetry of Graffiti by Kay Crown. And it goes like this. The poetry of graffiti, the conglomeration of all the aching wounds. Now there are no more secrets.
Did he get dropped?
I don't know. He probably did. I'm guessing anyways. You want to go ahead and read?
You know, I will bet you that if we chat for about 2 seconds, he will be back. Now, if he's not,
that is a good point.
I'll be happy to do it. But in the meantime, congratulations on that poem you wrote for tonight. It was really, really good.
Oh, thank you. Well, it was such an amazing night of poetry.
Yeah, not a clunker in there.
Yeah, and great prompts that Richard had picked out.
He did. Now, is he called back yet?
I don't know. Have you called back yet, Richard? He's happily reading away.
Yeah, I wonder if his phone didn't just crap out. Look, I'll be happy to pick up on this if you wish.
Okay.
All right. This is called The Poetry of Graffiti. The poetry of graffiti, a conglomeration of all the aching wounds. Now there are no more secrets. The writing is on the wall for each of us to wander through, amaze the shared reality of scattered bundles of pain that billow in relief, threads of the human condition sewn together with stitches of compassion. Where better a place to draw intricate patterns that spin across the page, that have no fairy tales of happily ever after or of a life adorned with roses, just the dribbling hopes, scribblings of blues, and snuffed out dreams on fields of the mundane. Disenchantment woven into the tapestry of bleeding hearts, that it throbbed with a passion to change the world, that there be no more discord or skeletons of shriveled up people locked in grungy dungeons of despair. The art of humanity, the shredded confetti of grief, spluttered, splattered, and sprayed across the page. End poem.
Thanks, Laurent. And thanks for picking up. For whatever reason, the technology just dropped me, and I had a heck of a time getting back.
We gave you time to get back, and I hoped that you would, but alas.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, I didn't catch all of your read, but I had read the poem beforehand. And you did a laudable job with what I did hear. I heard pretty much the last stanza. Great job there. And what a beautiful piece of poetry, a powerful ode to graffiti, for it is the raw poetry of urban blight and contemporary despair. I thought it was a strong speaking of truth to power, Very nicely done. And Pam, what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, this is beautifully written. It's raw. It's emotive. I like how it takes a look at the brilliance of artwork and, as you said, the urban landscape and the importance of art, the importance of poetry, you know. And I was particularly taken with that last stanza, starting with the lines, disenchantment woven into the tapestry of bleeding hearts that had throbbed with a passion to change the world. That wonderful idea of when we're hit with the ugliness of life, we so badly want to change it. You know, excellent write and very well done.
Great comments. And Laurent, as reader, I'll give you final word.
Yeah, I love poetry of graffiti. Most people will acknowledge that graffiti can be art, and if so, it certainly is inextricably wound up with poetry and with music, certainly. And that graffiti that we see is usually stark, vivid, florid, angry, sad. It's profane. Some of it is not. But when you call it a conglomeration of all the aching wounds, you really do talk about the shared reality of scattered bundles of pain that billow in relief, thrown on the walls, as it were. As Kay calls it, the threads of the human condition, which is so nicely done. Great piece.
Absolutely. Great comment. Okay, so I don't know, is there a real brevity left, or I think you're called?
Read fast, Richard.
We do actually have one that's fairly short that I think we can read and comment on. Plus, if we go off air,
great.
You know, and that'll be all right. We can do that. So,
Laurent and I have already gone off air.
All right, so we have Nabokov Nonsense by Bill Schiller, and Lauren, go ahead and give that a read, please.
Don't trust. Okay, the thing is short. I got no voice left. Nabokov, oh, this one. Bill, what am I going to do with you? Nabokov Nonsense. Nabokov once noted, words without experience are meaningless. I only know a consideration without context usually lacks truthfulness. For Nabokov, a Russian knockoff turned postmodernist hack, his thoughts should be unshackled from misled perspective. To presume useful words only follow the experiential is too detrimental. H.G. Wells traveled through time as Jules Verne sank beneath brine. Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote of Lord in Jungle, yet never preen in loincloth. Vonnegut concocted life on Saturn's moon, never joining crew on rocket. Imagination will often make up for whatever experience lacks. So no, Mr. Nabokov, trains of thought aren't necessarily dependent on laid tracks. End poem.
Great read, Laurent. And, whether you agree with the philosophical argument put forth by Bill or disagree with it, it's certainly a well-reasoned response to the prompt. And so I thought it was a nicely crafted brevity. And Laurent, as reader, I'll give you final word, and then we'll turn it over to Pam for a preview of what's coming up in 30 minutes.
Yeah, I admire the way he wrote this. All right, don't get me wrong. I agree with you. But it's an argument against only the experiential. Ultimately, imagination rides its train of thought, laying its tracks as it goes. Experience of a general world nature, not specific to a written subject, lays a firm groundwork for imagination. I think Nabokov might have meant words without any thorough learned experience of life is meaningless. However, your point is taken. But to call him a hack, no.
Yeah, I agree with you. Okay, so Pam, very quickly, what's coming up in 30 minutes?
30 minutes, we have Break On Through, where first we'll have carryovers from William Blake's poem, The Human Abstract, and then we will be delving into rites inspired by the art of André Masson. And so readers, commenters, and poetry, always welcome.
Thanks so much. And thanks, everyone, for joining me. We will see you in 2 weeks. Hopefully, Neutron will be back. Okay, have a good night, everyone. Thank you.
Good night.